Welcome to Conscious Communication, the podcast that can help you improve your company's culture and better your team's communication, helping you build more significant relationships. Now here's your host, Philip Bogolub.
I have the privilege and honor of talking with Dr. Ivan Meisner. He is the founder and chief visionary officer of BNI, Business Networking International. He founded it in 1985. He's got over 10,800 chapters, over 77 countries, 12.4 million referrals. The numbers are just staggering. He has a PhD from the University of Southern California. He's written over 28 books, part of the Board of Trustees at the University of Laverne. I could go on and on and on. A father of modern networking. And he's been interviewed on CNN, Forbes. He's been everywhere. Dr. Meisner, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me.
Philip, thank you. And please call me Ivan.
Ivan. Oh, I wanted to give you the creds.
You know, it's like Dr. Evil, if you ever saw those movies.
So,
you know what PhD stands for, don't you?
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Pilot higher and deeper.
I can't say anything to that, but you know, but you have that statistical, you have that thing behind you, and it take what 10 years? How many years did it take you to get
it
the PhD?
It did take me about 10. I went through a number of issues, including relationship issues, business issues. So it took me about 10 years.
Okay, and it wasn't easy.
No, it was not.
They don't make it easy. So
never.
I'm going to start with one question that I'm doing with every guest is. Before we talk about his book, his latest book is called Who's in Your Room? And I've got little markers on it to ask questions, go into it. I love it. It's about the mind. It really is about the mind.
Yeah.
What was the turning point in your life when you were younger that was the aha moment, that was finding your purpose on planet Earth, that serendipity, that coincidence that guided you to where you are now? Where was that thing that changed that?
Well, you know, there's a few when you're young. I think the very first one was a freshman in high school. The first week in class, I had run for student council. It's rare I talk about this, by the way. You've asked a question that I rarely talk about. I had run for student council in junior high because I loved student government. I was really interested in it, but I lost every time. And I didn't just lose. I was decimated. I was like the laughing stock of the school because I kept losing so badly. And so now I'm a freshman in high school. And I'm like, yeah, I've been there, done that. I'm not going to run for student council again. That's just very humbling. And in my freshman class, freshman history class, the history professor, teacher, I remember him to this day. It was a long time ago, Mr. Romero. And Mr. Romero said, all right, because you're all transferring from junior high to here, no student council representatives were selected last year. So we pick this year's student council representatives from freshman history, because every freshman has to take the history class.
Okay.
So are there any nominations? And there were none. He asked, okay, no nominations. Is anyone interested? None. And I sure as heck wasn't good.
No.
And then I'll never forget one of the girls, this is a true story, I'm not making this up. One of the girls, her name was Cindy, she raised her hand. Mr. Romero said, yes, Cindy, are you interested? And Cindy goes, no, no, Mr. Romero, I would be, but I'm so busy with cheerleaders. I can't possibly do it. I just wanted to let you know I'm not available. And he's like, okay, thank you so much. I appreciate you letting me know you're not available. Is there anyone who is at all interested? Nobody raised their hand. And I was dying to do it, but there was no way I was going to put myself through that again, right? So he then says, Mr. Romero, I'm what, 13 years old? He says, okay, so if you don't pick, I'm empowered to pick someone. And I can pick whoever I want. Are you okay with that? And they're like, yeah, pick anyone. We don't care. He's like, all right, sure. Yeah, we're fine. Good. And so he looks around the room. He looks at me. And he says, and I barely know him. I knew him for a week. It was like Friday of the first week of school. He looks at me and he says, Ivan, I bet you would like to do this, wouldn't you?
Oh, that's wild. He doesn't even know anything about you.
Not really. I mean, he knew me for a week.
Okay.
And I said, well, yeah, Mr. Romero, I would like to do it. And he said, okay, Ivan is our student council representative. And everyone, Philip, I mean, the entire class was like, oh, no, not Ivan. Anybody but Ivan. Okay. I'm serious. This is what happened. And then Cindy goes, oh, well, Mr. Romero, if you're going to pick Ivan, then I'll do it. And I'm like, I mean, imagine you're 13.
Right.
And you're sitting there in a room of peers. And they all diss you unanimously.
Right.
You feel so small. You just want to shrink. You don't know your future.
No.
You don't know that someday you're going to get graduate degrees, you're going to start a business, you're going to write dozens of books, you're going to have an international company. You just feel small and hurt. And God bless Romero. He said, nope, you gave me the power. I pick Ivan. He's going to be our student council representative. Everybody open up your book and turn to chapter 2.
Wow.
And I will never forget it. So I spent that year, because it was a one-year term, busting my butt. For several reasons. One, the primary reason was I wanted to make Mr. Romero proud. I wanted to make him feel like he made a good choice. Nobody wanted it. I was happy to do it. And I wanted him to feel like, okay, I picked well. I wanted that. And I also wanted my classmates to recognize I wasn't a doofus. You know, for whatever reason, they thought right. I was. You know what it is. When you're in junior high, everybody's weird. It's a horrible situation. And for a lot of junior high, I was overweight and blah, blah, blah. We all have our sad songs.
Right.
And I had mine. And I wanted my peers to recognize that I took this seriously. Now, here's the beauty, Phil.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of that year, when it came time to select the sophomore class student council representative, because they do it the year before, except junior high.
Okay.
When it came time for that same class to select the sophomore student council representative, they voted for me. That same class that said, oh no, not Ivan. I was the first junior to ever be elected to an ASB officer, and I ended up as ASB president
my senior year.
You ask me what was the turning point. That was one of a number of turning points in high school for me that gave me an opportunity to do something I loved, to excel, to show what I was capable of, and to be inspired to do things that I love. Absolutely changed the trajectory of my life. If Mr. Romero hadn't picked me, I don't know. Maybe we might not be talking today. Who knows? I might not. You really don't know. So that really is the turning point, I think, in my life. And there have been many, many other supportive turning points. For example, my student council representative, once I was in, Mr. Rogers, he was amazing. In my sophomore year, after I did my sophomore year, he said, what are you going to do next year? I said, I'm going to run for student council again. He said, no. I said, why? He said, you need to run for ASB office. I'm like, you can't be an ASB office, sir, as a junior. He said, who said? I said, well, there are no juniors who are ASB officers. He said, yeah, so what? He said, really? You can be an ASB officer as a junior? He said, yeah, you should be activities director. You're really good at it. I'm like, I can do that. He's like, yeah. So I did, and I won. And then at the end of my junior year, he says to me, so what are you doing next year? I don't know. I'll run for something probably.
Do you suggest something?
He said, yeah, you need to run for president. I said, really? He's like, come on, really? You're the first ASB officer to ever be a junior. You're rocking it in the student council. Yeah, you need to run for president. And, you know, it's okay. So here's the lesson for everyone. You take those people who, and you talked about my book, Who's in Your Room. You take those people who are engines in your life. In the book, I talk about engines and anchors. Engines are people who propel you forward because they're there for you. They love you. They care for you. They want you to be a better version of yourself. Anchors are people that just bring you down. Those two men were absolute engines in my life. They propelled me to a place I didn't see myself in at the moment that I was talking to them. We all need people like that in our lives.
And that's a wonderful story. And that's why I like asking these stories, because, and you're right, there's all, I call them God winks. They're like little nudges that just push you in that direction. And those coincidences, those serendipities,
yeah,
you have no clue what you're going to do in your life.
No, none. I did not have much self-confidence as that freshman.
No, and then you worked really hard for, was it Romero?
Yeah, for Romero, for the freshman class.
It was pride in yourself going, if you're going to have confidence in me, I'm going to show you that it's worth having the confidence in me.
Yep, I want to make sure that I lived up to your hopes, your right. expectations.
And that's interesting, because I totally believe that there's a lot of things, instead of classifying things as mistakes, you can't learn anything. You don't learn anything. And I don't classify them as mistakes. I classify them as life. If you don't trip, and I don't even know, sometimes you do it to ourselves. There's always an exception to the rule, but it's still, you've got to learn. It's either an opportunity to learn something or an opportunity to just sit there, as you say, an anchor. You could be your own anchor.
Oh, yeah. Many people are their own anchors.
You know, and you just,
and
it
sometimes
weighs you
they
down.
Have an engine attached to it.
Yeah, right. Going 100 miles an hour, and it just keeps bouncing back and
forth. You called them God what?
God winks.
God winks. My late wife called them God stops.
I like that.
God stops, where it just makes you stop.
Yes.
And think.
Yes.
And I like to say, things that are intuitive, your intuition is your soul talking to you.
Absolutely. But you have to be in the right mind. I call the subconscious or the conscious, whatever people call it. You have to be in that right mindset. And if you're in that conscious mind folders of constant, I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it, the same repetitive thing.
Words
if you're
have
not,
power.
Huh?
Words have power.
Absolutely. And I mean, do you also meditate, pray?
I do. I should meditate more. But in a way, I meditate every day. I take a steam shower every day, and I do contemplative meditation in the steam. And then a couple times a week, I will do a more traditional kind of meditation. I also have a stone labyrinth at my home, and I walk the stone labyrinth. I have a quarter of a mile walking path around my house.
Oh, nice.
And so, you know, I walk and think as I walk the path. I walked a mile this morning on the path.
One of the things I've been doing as of late is the mundane things in life. There's a lot of them. Cleaning a toilet. I don't care what it is. And it came to me because I meditated and I prayed on it. And I asked him, like, okay, I need some help here. I got to get something out of it. I want to get something out of it coming to a stoplight. I want to learn something. I don't want that time wasted. So I start thinking about things, and I write things down. I listen to a positive audiobook. I listen to some positive music. I read your book. I stop, because one of the things is books like what you wrote, Who's in Your Room. I am contemplative about it. I stop. I put it. It could be just one chapter or a couple of pages. I'm like, oh, and I have a pencil and paper around, because it's a time to think. And before I go to bed, I always meditate, and I believe sleeping is probably the most important time of your day, because that's when your mind solves problems, and it's in the imagination, and it could release things. And that's something, as you go to bed with something negative, you're going to sleep with something negative. You're in that soup for 8 to 10 hours. So, okay. So I've got to hit the book. First of all, I love the name, Who's in Your Room? if nobody, the people that are listening, if you have not gotten it, it's called Who's in Your Room by Ivan Meisner, M-I-S-N-E-R. Please go out and get it. It's a very quick read. And the reason why I say it's a quick read, because it's written in Nun Psychologies, and it's very relatable and very opens up your imagination very clearly. So I'm going to start with the first thing. Imagine that you live in one room. Imagine that you live your entire life in this room, where you and your imagination create your life. So we make up our life anyway. I mean, we're basically our own actors in our own movies. Could you please elaborate a little bit on that, how you've used that in your life with your imagination?
Well, you know, when you let people into your life, now when we were young, we didn't have much control over it. Our life was like a revolving door of people coming in. The thing that we talk about in the book, though, is that when people come into your life, they're there forever. When they come into your room, they're there forever. And sometimes I get people who will argue with me and say, well, no, I can get people out of my life. I go, okay. So I run them through this little exercise. Do you mind if we do it right now?
Go.
Okay, so what I want you to do, Philip, is I want you to think of somebody that you got out of your life. That was toxic, difficult, whatever. You didn't like him. You wanted him out of your life. Now, if you're watching this or listening to this, I want you to also think of someone you got out of your life. They were difficult. Now, Philip, I'm not going to make you say who it is, but do you have somebody?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, what I want you to do, and if you're listening or watching, I want you to do this as well. I want you to think of what it was they did last, or one of the last things they did that made you say, that's it, no more, you are out of my life. I want you to feel what you felt then.
Ugh.
You feel it?
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal. If they're still in your head, they're still in your room, and they will be for the rest of your life. When you let people into your life that are toxic and difficult, or they're dissonant with your values, incongruent with your values, they're going to impact your life in very negative ways. Now, when you let people into your room or into your life, and people say, well, you know, I'll put them in the next room. There is no next room. Here's the room.
There's no basement.
Here is the room. The room starts on this side of the temple of your head, and it ends on this side of the temple of your head. It is your brain. It's your mind.
Right.
And so that's your room. And so there are people in my room like Mr. Romero and Mr. Rogers that changed my life in incredible ways. They will always be there. There are also people like, and I won't name them, who are also in my room and changed my life in not so great ways. But they're still there, and we learn from it. And you might take those other people, and in the book we say, you know, take those negative people, put them in a box. This is something my mother taught me as a kid, that when I had a challenge in life and I was obsessing over something, put that problem in a box, stick it on a shelf really high. It'll be there when you need to go to it again.
Oh, you got that from your mom. Okay.
I got that from my mom. Yeah. I got several things from my mom. If I have any people skills whatsoever, I got it from my mom, got my dad. And what I got from my dad was my work ethic. He was a very, very hardworking man.
Yeah. My grandma was the way I think, the way I act, the way I treat people. My dad was more of the work ethic.
Yep.
It's interesting because the way I look at it is I ask myself the two W's in the negative way and say, okay, what am I supposed to learn from this? What am I supposed to get out of this? And you're 100, I don't know why everybody says 110%, but that's what we do. Well, 100.
Yeah, well, and you what, can't. 100% is as much as it goes.
It's 100.3. 100% is, it never does leave you. Those things pop up with a smell, a taste, a touch,
yeah,
a food, a sound, a song. And I've learned for myself to ask that. What am I supposed to learn? What am I supposed to get? Because it's not like toxic people are not going to come into your life. It's not like you're choosing. You want to send out that positive energy, but life happens. And you go, well, why did that happen? And what can I learn from it? And that's really helped me. But you're absolutely right. Because your whole system, the minute you brought that up, my stomach started gurgling.
Right.
Your whole body, it doesn't know the difference between what happened today or 10 years ago or 30. It doesn't matter. And it is amazing.
Yeah, and
how
that's why it's really important to be careful about the people you let into your room. And one of the, what I love about this book is that it helps people think about the kind of people that you let into your life.
Okay, that perfect lead-in. So the next part is a question. I'm just making the comment here. So what can be unconscious to us is perfect, can blindingly obvious to others people, which can be a catalyst for all kinds of grief. Developing self-awareness can help significantly. You can become skilled at identifying the inner experiences of resonance and dissonance, right frequency, the wrong frequency, and then consciously choose how to behave in any given moment. Expand on that a little bit more, because I do the two W's. I do my own process of procedure, but I love the way you describe this. Give me an example of something that you do to get yourself out of this with that particular statement.
Well, I mean, I look for resonance in interactions with people and not dissonance. And I'm not a musician, but I've observed what I'm about to describe.
Okay.
I observed it with a guitar versus a piano. But in the book, we talk about two pianos side by side. And one person is sitting at one piano, another at the other piano, and the one person hits the middle C key of the first piano, and the person sitting at the second piano just presses the sustain pedal, doesn't hit a key. The miraculous thing about this is that the second piano hums, even though you didn't hit a string. That's resonance. And what you want in relationships, personal and professional, are relationships that are resonant, not dissonant. Relationships that are congruent, not incongruent. Now, they don't have to be the same. And we talk in the book about the importance of values. And you got to get good with your values. I mean, in this book, and you know, you can't go very far in making the book and the ideas work for you unless you know your values. So you got to get good with your values. Now, your values and my values don't have to be the same to be congruent. They just can't be incongruent. They can't be so far apart that you can't work together.
Okay, it's got to be a negative positive. It can't be two negatives, two positives coming, trying to, because it'll just repel each other.
Yeah, or it's going to be a neutral positive.
Okay.
You know,
oh, I like that.
It's like, that doesn't mean a lot to me, but that doesn't bother me.
Right, and it's an energy feeling. It's kind of like, and when you're describing that as, you've done this before. You go into somebody's house and you feel love, you feel happiness, you feel great.
Yeah.
You go into somebody else's house and you feel like, is something wrong here? Why does it feel so dark and dismal and depressing? And so you kind of have that gut or instinct feeling. How do you, before I go to the next question, because I want to talk about something else with the doorman. I love that analogy. How do you deal with the instantaneous moment that something comes up? So, for instance, you're my boss. I go into your office. You say you're fired, or you're yelling at me, and you don't have time to, you know, put your arms together and go, oh, you can't do that. How can you apply this book? I know we're just touching it, and we don't have enough time to go on every, I talked to you for hours about this book. This is a wonderful book. How can you do that in real time? How can you do some of this stuff in real time? If you see something negative, or something, because it does happen. It happens all the time.
Look, we all screw up. I mean, I literally, 2 days ago, I had a very serious conversation with somebody, and I screwed up. You know, I said things I probably shouldn't have said that you just blurt out in the middle of an emotional environment, an emotional situation. It happens to all of us. I think the key is that when something's happening to you, if your lizard brain is not in control, you know, you listen, you observe, and you sit back, and then you make a decision on what you want to do. I mean, there have been situations, you gave a work example. My problem was a personal relationship. But in a work example, you know, I sat through a meeting where I was appalled at what the boss was saying, just appalled. And I was really tempted to speak up, but I thought, I need to think this through before I just speak up. And I thought it through overnight, and I quit the next day.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, easy peasy, no knockdown drag out, which it could have been. Now, having said that, I screwed up a couple of days ago and, you know, created a challenge on a personal relationship. And so nobody's perfect. You do your best. You apologize if you screw up, which I did. By the way, it didn't help much. but I did apologize. I think,
you know,
as a rule, listen, one of the things that my mom did for me, which was amazing, was she gave me this paperweight that's on my desk to this day. She gave this to me when I was 13, when I was finally doing student council.
Oh, cool.
She gave this to me.
Okay.
33 years ago. It says, diplomacy is the art of letting someone else have your way. Diplomacy is the art of letting someone else have your way. She said, honey, you are a bull in a china shop. You just knock people over. She said, you got to learn how to work with people if you want to be a leader. This is about collaboration, not manipulation. But if you learn how to collaborate with people, you can be good at leading people. It's good advice. And it's something that, you know, we have to remind ourselves of consistently, and nobody's perfect. I'm not.
Well, my dad used to tell me that my grandma actually started that one. She said, she died when she was 99. She said, the only time you stop making mistakes is when you're 6 feet under the ground. And you never stop learning, because
it's
all about learning, and it's about growing. And I tell people that it's not the quantity of life, it's the quality of life. And what are you doing here, not after you're gone, and how you touch people's lives. And yeah, we're human. We make mistakes, and you can't stop that unless you live in a cave somewhere and you don't ever come out. And that's not going to get you anywhere. So,
yeah, and you know, it's funny because I read it like a day too late. I read this really good statement that said, don't make a permanent decision in an emotional situation.
Oh.
Don't make a permanent decision
in an emotional situation.
And, you know, I'm okay with the decision I made, but I probably made a permanent statement in an emotional state, which was, it was stupid. So
we get emotional, we say things.
We all do it. Don't beat yourself up. Here's the thing. I always have said, I don't have very many regrets because I really tried to live my values in life. And if you live your values, you're going to make mistakes. It happens. If you make a mistake based on the best information you have at the moment, then give yourself grace.
Well,
it's the tuition that you pay for being successful.
Hmm.
I define myself by my successes, not my failures. And I have got a boatload of failures. A boatload. I probably have more failures than people who think they're a failure have.
Right.
But it's because I define myself for the most part by my successes, not my failures.
Well, there's no book for everything. You're not supposed to know everything when you're going down a road of unknown stuff. I'm doing that right now in my life.
Not only is there no book for everything, the truth is there's no book for everything, for every personality that you're dealing with.
Right.
You know, that it's a whole different book for this personality than it is this personality.
Yeah, it doesn't. Well, you were also talking about talking about forgiveness. I believe unforgiveness, not so much for the other person, but for yourself. You're talking about being an anchor. You know, unforgiveness is something that happened in the past. The past is the past. You can't do anything about it. You could clear it up if you want. You could do the best. You can't force somebody to accept it if something went wrong, and you can't change people, but you can learn from it and say, okay, maybe when I see that happening, if I hear my mind coming up with that particular thing, and before it comes out of my physical being, my mom used to, I'm Jewish, and my mother she went to Yiddish school, and there was a saying we grew up with called "Vermach de Moel," which means shut your mouth. And I always remember that. It doesn't mean it doesn't come out of my mouth, but you have to forgive yourself and you have to forgive others. I mean, you know, in general, because most people aren't going to do something intentionally, including yourself. It just happens.
Yeah.
So I wanted you to go over the doorman. picture.
Well, the doorman principle, which we've got a second edition of the book coming out in late January, and we've changed the name to doorkeeper to make it more politically correct.
Okay.
So the doorkeeper is your conscious and subconscious mind. And it is really, it's you training yourself to screen the door and not allow people in that are anchors, that are negative, that are toxic. You know, you keep them out on the balcony, on the porch.
Okay.
And you don't let them into your room. Now, look, you know, there are times where, I mean, it's like family members, they're in. They're in your room.
You didn't get to choose them.
You didn't get to choose them. People that you've let into your room before, you understand this concept. They're in. To some extent, people you work with, so, you know, that somehow they get in. Yeah, although you can kind of keep a lot of them on your porch, actually. But they do get in. And so the doorkeeper is your conscious and subconscious mind to help make sure to allow people into your life that are engines and not anchors.
Yeah, go over the engine and anchors. I love that analogy. So I was going to go into another part, but I just love that. Engines and anchors. And it's pretty self-explanatory, at least in my mind, but that doesn't mean the listeners understand it. So kind of go over that a little bit.
Well, engines are people in your life that propel you forward in a positive way. They're there for you. They want the best for you. They make you a better version of yourself.
Man.
Anchors are people that are just bringing you down all the time. And we have had friends. I've had friends where, you know, I'm talking about something I'm really excited about and they just bring me down. And they tell me why it can't be done and why I'm being crazy and what's all the things that are wrong with what I'm thinking. And look, you know, a good friend will also tell you, you might want to think about that.
That's true.
But we know, I think you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. There are some people that just are consistently anchors.
Yeah.
And they make you a lesser version of yourself, a poorer version of yourself. Brilliant. And those are the ones that you want to leave out of your life. And if they're in your life, you want to put them in a box and put them far away. And you do that through, in the book, we talk about benign neglect and homeopathic doses. And, you know, benign neglect works, even if you're not trying to make it work. You know, we all have friends of ours in high school, college, people who we liked, they were friends, but yet over time, through benign neglect, not on purpose, we've just lost the relationship. And the relationship has dissipated. Now imagine doing that with a plan. You've got somebody that's an anchor and you want out of your life, and through benign neglect and homeopathic doses, the least amount necessary to interact, you can get them out of your life. They're still in your head, they're still in your room, but you kind of get them out of your life and into the recesses of your life. Now, my son, God bless my son, I love him. And he's like, Dad, just tell him you're out. I don't like you anymore. Like, yeah, okay, that's not my style. So if it works for you, that's great. But for me, I'd rather not burn bridges. I'm not looking to burn a bridge with somebody that I have a relationship with, but I am looking to no longer have them be an anchor in my life.
And it's hard to do because we've all had those. And as you get older and more experiences in your life, it grows. And, you know, with family, I've told people, you know, just, you know, if it's somebody close to you and you love them, but they're always negative, just go there for birthdays and holidays and then maybe a phone call or two and then stay away from it. Because if you're always there going, hey, how you doing? I don't know. Everything stinks.
Yeah.
Is the sun up? No, the sun's down. It was something I was reading a while ago. If you wake up and say, good morning, God, or do you say, good God, it's morning, you know, and it's important to surround those people as much as you possibly can, however that works. And everybody's different with the positive stuff, not the negative.
Yeah. And I talk about in the book, and you may remember a technique or two, Rick and his mother and how he handled her negativity. There's something that's not in that edition of the book that's going to be in the next edition that I'll share with you if you'd like.
Please.
I had a woman who read the book and she said, oh my goodness, this changed my family dynamic. because I took it to my family and I talked to them about it. And we have a sibling who every time she came to one of the family dinners, she would, at some point in the evening, throw in this verbal hand grenade that would just explode everything. It would be something so divisive that people would start arguing and yelling, and the evening would end horribly. And she did this constantly. And so I took this to my family without her present.
Right.
And we all agreed, this is going to be in the second edition, we all agreed that the next time she came to a family dinner and she threw in a family hand, she threw in a hand grenade into the family dinner, that we would all be firm and simply look at her and go, oh, okay. And turn back to the person that you're talking to and just continue the conversation.
You diffused it.
Saying nothing other than, oh, okay. And sure enough, the next family event, boom, everybody had a look at her and was like, oh, interesting, okay. And they turned back and she was like,
what happened?
What happened? And she ended up leaving early. And she said that she comes to some family events occasionally, but she never comes to all of them anymore. And she stopped throwing in hand grenades because nobody reacts. And God, who knows what somebody gets out of that? I have no idea what somebody would get out of.
Oh, no. Just throwing a bomb to get people all pissed off and arguing, and they sit back. I call them energy suckers.
Yeah, they're vampire suckers for
sure. They feel stronger.
Yeah,
throwing out a negative and sucking your positive energy away than they do anything else. And you don't know why. And you don't know what folder it came from, where they learned that, or how that skill, or I don't know if it's a skill, but
I don't know why, but I'm sure it's a complicated psychological term.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, with multiple names that I can't pronounce or
that's
spell.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So I wanted to go also, I mean, I'm never going to get to everything today, but the physical and spiritual well-being. I maintain healthy practices, including diet, exercise, we talked about meditation, and I avoid things that may damage my health or psyche. And that's a big thing for me. It's not so much the exercise. Whatever you think, you become. You become what you think about. You talk what you think about. You're just like that family member. You are what you think about, and you just go throw it out there to screw up everybody.
If you believe it, you become it.
Yes, exactly. So you obviously practice these things and keep the psyche clear. Is there a daily practice? Like in the morning for me, I do a gratitude journal every day.
Yeah.
And I don't get out of bed until I'm positive. Sometimes I'm there for 4 days, but then but you know what I mean. I do my prayers, I do my meditation. Everybody's got something different. What do you do for yourself in the morning or before you go to bed that that starts your day in a positive way?
I get up, I exercise every morning, and that's a change from 10 years ago. After I was diagnosed with cancer, I kind of changed my eating and health regimen. And so I exercise every day in the morning, and then I take that steam shower. My steam shower has become my refuge where I can just relax and contemplate and get into meditation. I've come up with some amazing ideas while just sitting there clearing my mind. So I do that every morning. And then I have breakfast and get started. Now, before my wife passed away, I would get up and then the first thing in the morning, every morning, the vitamin fairy just showed up and had these little packets of vitamins. They were just there. And I was like, ooh, the vitamin fairy came. I would have my morning vitamins.
Oh, my God. Well, I think the thing to take away with that is we don't allow ourselves enough silence.
Yeah.
And I think what you do in your steam and your walk, your exercise, and there's so many things that, and pull the technology away. If there was no technology, would there be something else to take our attention away from? But it's important to have nothing. It's important to have quiet.
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it really does lend itself to that imaginational subconscious mind creating it, ideas that just suddenly are like, where did that come from?
You know, yeah, the silence is important. I think millennials kind of get a bad rap on technology. I saw something on the internet not long ago about a bus stop, and everybody was looking at their phone. Everybody sitting in there was looking at their phones. And I looked at that and I thought, you know, when I was in my early 20s, I worked in Los Angeles and I took a bus to LA every day. It was a commuter bus, long, you know, 45-minute drive to right. LA. And I would see the bus stops. Now, we're talking about 1981, 82.
Okay.
There was no difference, except instead of phones, it was magazines and newspapers.
Good point.
Everyone was sitting there reading a magazine. Or reading a newspaper, or reading a book. The mechanism may have changed. But people, I think, in many ways, are less different than we think they are. Because I remember that 50 years ago.
You're right.
And it was the same. I looked at that photo, I'm like, just replace it with a book. And it was the same thing I saw years ago.
It's true. It's like when people complain about politics or whatever, and you look back 50 years ago, it was the same mess. It's a mess. It's always going to be a mess. It's going to be a mess after we're gone, whatever it is. It could be family situations. It could be work. Yeah. It could be everybody says it's always the worst time.
There are times where it's really bad, and then there are other times where it's just bad.
Yeah. And what could you do about it? Nothing. You know?
Not much. Although I'll tell you one thing that we can do about it. I stopped listening to the news. I just read my news on apps. I think we need to microdose the news. Because I remember the day where Walter Cronkite would get on and he would read the news.
Right.
And if he had an opinion, across the bottom of the screen would be this little scrolling thing.
Opinion or what do they call it? The commentary.
This is a commentary by our newscaster.
That's right.
This is not necessarily the opinion of this television station.
That's right.
Now you knew you were listening to Walter's opinion.
Right.
The news stations now should be called opinion stations because they just spout the opinion. And it doesn't matter. It does not matter whether you're talking about left or right.
Doesn't matter.
It's the opinions.
Yeah.
And the problem, here's the problem with it. Well, there's two. One is they pitch it as fact.
Right.
And the truth is, it's their version of the fact.
Right.
And the second thing is it's divisive.
Yes. That's the biggest.
It's highly divisive.
It's that family member throwing a bomb in.
It is. And so I have not watched a news station since COVID started. I mean, I watched a little bit when COVID started. It's like, oh yeah, no, I'm out. Because it was, you know, the world was coming to an end. Now, I get my news by going to apps. So, I might look at CNN and then look at Fox, and I figure, okay, the truth is somewhere in between.
Right.
It's somewhere in between those two.
It's entertainment.
It's negative entertainment. Negative entertainment. But I pick and choose the topics that I really want to hear about or look at.
Right.
And yeah, what a mess. We need to microdose the news. I'll tell you what we really need. We need an independent news network, certainly in North America, a news network that doesn't take a position.
It's got to have facts, and then you would have to give, this is the absolute fact, here's from the horse's mouth, as they say, and then you'd have to show it, and then you say nothing. You say absolutely nothing.
Let me offer another.
Or you do a commentary.
Yeah. Well, a doubled commentary. I've thought this through. So you give what you said. Look, before we went online, we were talking about statistical data, and I said to torture the data long enough, it'll confess to anything.
Right.
So you know the left and right can get the data to confess to anything.
Right.
So I think you need an independent person that can give the data as cleanly as possible, and then you let someone on the left and then someone on the right talk. And here's the beauty of it. There's got to be a mute button.
Oh, God.
Okay.
That means there's not going to be a lot of talking.
Well, no, there's got to you can say, that you can left, you can say what you want. You got 2 minutes. And then you're muted right? Yeah. You got 2 minutes.
Yep.
And then you're muted. And if left starts over talking on right, they're muted again.
Yep.
And I mean, to me, that would be the closest thing to what the truth is.
Well, the only thing I could think of, my wife's an actuary. She's data driven, factual data, and getting things into the future. But yeah, it's what I call thought noise. And it's just, and you're absolutely right. That example with the newspaper.
So data driven is good. And I'm for it. And it needs to be that. And if data was completely accurate, Dewey would have been president, not Truman.
That's a good point.
So Dewey can be wrong. I mean, data can be wrong.
This is very true.
So I like the data. I would want it. I'm in agreement with you. And I
it
also
could still
think
be
you
manipulated.
Need to hear both sides.
Yeah. And to the point, again, I was reading about Confucius the past couple of weeks. The man was thrown out. This is 3,000 years ago for politics because he didn't agree with the people that were in charge in China and all this other stuff. Nothing changes. Absolutely nothing. The times change. People don't. I am noticing the time, Ivan, and I don't want to go over. You're going to be now my second permanent guest forever, so I can keep going over the book for the next 500 years.
Listen, I'm happy to talk about the book again, or we never got to the whole question of balance. So maybe bring me back.
We can spend
a lot of time talking about balance.
I only got to 3 tabs out of the entire book. So I want to thank you again for taking the time. I really appreciate it. And I'm honored to have that conversation. I love talking about the mind, and you really got a good grasp on what's going on. And to my conscious community, remember, it is more important to express your thinking thoughts and not the thoughts you are thinking. That is what is called conscious communication. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to Conscious Communication. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and recommend on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcast. You can also get more great information at ConsciousCommunicationPodcast.com.